Hi, I'm Robert Ambrose. I'm a DJ and music DJ and a long recovered journalist way back in the day. And I'm here as co-presenter of this program, Critical Conversations, along with Dar Jamail.
Hi, everybody. And I am Dar Jamail. I am a recovering journalist, war reporter, and current author.
When we started this show a few months ago, just before the 2020 election, our goal was to explore, through conversation, the existential crises that threaten human civilization. Our hope is that by bringing these difficult topics into a wider community discourse, we may all be better prepared to meet an uncharted future. The magnitude of changes since we started the show are breathtaking. It's as if reality shifted gears and these crises are accelerating. But of course, what most of us are trying to wrap our heads around, what really has preoccupied all of us, are the events that happened last week in Washington, D.C.
So we'll touch on the other two crises that we've been tracking during this show, but then we'll focus back on the first American coup and what it reflects about this country at this point in history. So Robert, how about you get us started with giving us an update on the COVID-19 crisis?
Sure. The crisis, as everybody is probably aware, is a growing crisis. About 3,300 people in the U.S. are dying every day, and the country is just about to surpass 400,000. In the next couple of days, 400,000 people dead. Where's the societal grieving for this enormously tragic loss that is devastating families and communities?
It really is shocking. Another statistic I saw was that 1 in 3 people in Los Angeles County are infected.
That's crazy. Maybe you could bring us up to date on what's going on with climate, because that's another thing that's under the radar at the moment, but it's so very important.
On the climate disruption front, things continue to become increasingly dire. Last year, it was tied for the record warmest year on the planet. And another piece of information that underscores the severity of that statistic is that this occurred during a La Nina, which meant it should have actually been a cooler year. And instead, it literally tied with the warmest year on the planet since record keeping began. And then distressingly, we're seeing also, even now in January, in Colorado and in other Western states, we're starting to see droughts being set up with lower than normal precipitation amounts, far warmer than normal temperatures. So a lot of the precipitation that's already falling is not becoming part of the snowpack. So once again, we're seeing the West set up for wildfires akin to what we saw last year. So again, the big elephant in the room of climate disruption is continuing apace.
But of course, what's really preoccupying all of us right now is the violence in Washington, D.C., the American coup, the attempted and nearly successful takeover of Congress and the cessation of Congress as a working body. White supremacists and ultra-right conspiracy believers, inspired by the president, violently invaded the center of U.S. constitutional democracy, leaving 5 people dead, shattering, but really not surprising.
What we want to do now is highlight several very, very key articles in an interview that have really helped both of our understanding of seeing what's happening here, because for most of us Americans, this is our first coup. And so by sharing these articles, and we're going to link them on the website and for this show specifically, so that definitely encourage people to go read these. The first of which was published in The Atlantic, and it's by colleague Zeynep Tüfekçi from Turkey, and the title of her article is "This Must Be Your First," and the subtitle is "Acting as if Trump is trying to stage a coup is the best way to ensure he won't." She talks specifically about the terminology in political science. Coup refers to the illegitimate overthrow of a sitting government, which usually is attempted through violence or at least the threat of violence. She goes on to talk about the incoherence and incompetence of the attempt that we have just witnessed. still do not change its nature, nor do those traits allow us to dismiss it or ignore it until it finally fails on account of that incompetence, which seems to be what a lot of people have been sort of assuming watching all of this play out.
One of the reasons, and maybe the prime reason for this coup failing, is that the U.S. military did not go along with it. In fact, a rare joint message, 7 U.S. military leaders condemned the Capitol riot. Quote, "The violent riot in Washington, D.C. on January 6, 2021 was a direct assault on the U.S. Congress, the Capitol building, and our constitutional process. The rights of freedom of speech and assembly do not give anyone the right to resort to violence, sedition, and insurrection."
So it was clear to her that Trump was attempting to stage some kind of coup and had been for quite some time, but it was a coup that was embedded in a broader and ongoing power grab by this administration. And she talks about, she makes this comment kind of glibly, but accurately, if that's hard to recognize, it's because this might be your first coup. So we can't really be blamed for missing some of these warning signs. She highlights how the president has repeatedly and baselessly claimed that the election was stolen from him and continues to do so to this day. He is effectively charging that election officers around the country were involved in a dangerous conspiracy and that the incoming president is the leader of this illegal attempt. And that essentially right there is the big lie, which we're going to talk much more about here shortly. She points out how the president and his key allies repeatedly called for Republican state legislatures to steal the election for him by appointing new electors who would support him instead of backing the winner of the state's electoral votes. Another point she makes is how the president, who has the power to appoint judges for lifetime appointments and who has appointed nearly a third of federal judges on the crucial circuit court level in the U.S., more than any other president in recent history at this point in their presidency, has asked the courts to throw out valid votes wholesale, especially in cities with minority voters. Another point, right after the election, a legal advisor to the president stated on national television, quote, "We're waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court, of which the president has nominated 3 justices, to step in and do something, and hopefully Amy Coney Barrett will come through," end quote. Another point she makes, the president has amplified messages that call for people to, quote, "fight back hard," end quote, against the allegedly stolen election. And then another point, Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor, a very powerful post, who was just pardoned by Trump, amplified calls for the president to suspend the Constitution and hold another election, an exercise presumably to be repeated until Trump wins. The president summarily fired Christopher Krebs, the director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency in the Department of Homeland Security, because he vouched that the election was not stolen. Another point, Joseph DeGenova, a lawyer for the Trump campaign, said that Krebs should be, quote, "taken out at dawn and shot," end quote.
Subtle that.
So what makes this moment so deeply alarming and makes Republicans' overwhelming silence and tacit approval so deeply dangerous, rather than merely an attempt to run out the clock on the president's clownish behavior, is that Trump's attempt to steal the election builds on a process that's been part of basically minority rule around the country now for decades. I mean, she goes into unrepresentative gerrymandering, voter suppression, other tactics that have been ongoing and embedded within this system now for several decades. So it's really, as she comes to the end, from Zainab's perspective, she says, quote, "We're being tested and we're failing. The next attempt to steal an election may involve a closer election and smarter lawsuits. Imagine the same playbook executed with better decorum, a president exerting pressure that is less crass and issuing tweets that are more polite. If most Republican officials are failing to police this ham-handed attempt at a power grab, how many would resist a smoother, less glossly embarrassing effort?" In her conclusions, you know, we have to remember that 74 million people who voted for Trump now believe the election was just downright stolen, and that's probably not going to change. I want to read verbatim just a few more lines of what she says, because I think she really hits the nail on the head here of why this is such a prescient and important moment in the history of this country. She says, "But ignoring near misses is how people in societies get into real trouble the next time. And although the academic objections to the terminology aren't incorrect, the problem is about much more than getting the exact term right. Alarmism is problematic when it's sensationalist. Alarmism is essential when conditions make it appropriate." Another way she puts this is, "The boy who cried wolf is a familiar parable. But what of the boy who saw an approaching wolf scared off by a thunderstorm and decided that he didn't need to worry about wolves, instead of readying himself for its return? Fortune favors the prepared. Catastrophe awaits those who confuse luck with strength."
I think she brings up many points that illustrate why it's really important that something that probably most people in this country were never able to think of as a possibility in this country, a coup, a takeover of power by a small group of people, and then to see this riot in Washington, which was white violence, writ large and on the big screen, and was the result of a president who's been blowing that dog whistle for years and years, creating a population that believes him no matter what he says.
Right. And just another thing about this article that I just read many quotes from, I just want to point out that article was written 1 month before January 6th. It was published on December 7th. So adds a little bit of credibility to this person's perspective.
And then we also saw an article that was just published a few days ago, or actually right after the events in Washington, written by Walden Bello, who's a Filipino academic and activist. He wrote an article, "America Has Entered the Weimar Era." His expertise is basically the overthrow of democracies. He studied the overthrow of the Chilean democracy in 1973, the other 9/11, by the way. One important thing that Walden Bello says, and I'm going to quote this actually, "American ideology, and there is American ideology, is suffering from a profound loss of credibility, including among Americans themselves. Two primordial beliefs undergird this ideology, and both have been irretrievably eroded. The so-called American dream is the first, and American exceptionalism is the second."
Another thing that I believe Walden touched on in that article, and that we mentioned before, Zainab touched upon the big lie, and the next person we're going to talk about talks about the big lie as well. And this is all a reference to a quote that I'd like to read from Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's propagandist. He wrote, quote, "If you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it. The lie can be maintained only for such time as the state can shield people from the political, economic, and/or military consequences of the lie. It thus becomes vitally important for the state to use all of its powers to repress dissent, for the truth is the mortal enemy of the lie. And thus, by extension, the truth is the greatest enemy of the state." So keep that in mind as we keep referencing back to the big lie.
Couple of thoughts on that. Trump is the cheerleader, the liar in chief. He's always been that way. He's like a vaudeville clown that practiced using the big lie when he led the birther conspiracy seeking to undermine Barack Obama. He later created the chanting cult with "Lock Her Up" that we all remember over and over. And that has for years sowed distrust in elections, culminating in his exhortation of followers who thoroughly believe him to fight, in quotes, to take back Congress, said right before they marched on Congress and occupied it.
And the other person that I'd like to bring attention to is Timothy Snyder. I've actually been following his writing since back right after Trump was inaugurated. Timothy Snyder, who's a fascism historian, he wrote an amazing book called On Tyranny. And ever since then, I've been following him closely. And he had an article that was, he basically had it written before the day of the coup, the overt coup attempt on the Capitol. And literally published in New York Times Magazine the day after. And it's because he already had it written, because he said that from his perspective, what he was seeing, what occurred was utterly predictable. So again, he talks often in the article about this big lie that we keep referencing. But in his perspective, the big lie, in particular with the United States, has to be rooted in race. And he backs that up by making some very important points, one of which is that when Trump says that he won the election, that it was because the election was a fraud. And by that, he means that African Americans should not be allowed to vote. That's essentially point one. Point two, Senator Cruz from Texas and his consistent invocation of 1877, which of course the Compromise of 1877, when the American South was allowed to build up a basically American apartheid. So what happened then, remembering, is what allowed American states to push African Americans away from voting booths and into a Jim Crow condition that was going to last from that point onwards, and we're still having to deal with that today. And then his third point to back up what he said was, look at the people who actually invaded the Capitol. These people are basically white supremacists. And in leading the way, it's a statement that they're making is that, hey, this is our house. In other words, what we think is that American government should be in the hands of white people who are willing to be violent about black people.
And many people that were interviewed afterwards said things like, the revolution was a violent thing, wasn't it? And the Civil War also was a struggle through arms. These people carrying Confederate flags illustrated that it was a racist, white supremacist invasion of Congress. Can there be any clearer illustration of this than invasion of Congress happened a day after black people in Georgia delivered two Democratic Party senators to flip the Senate? Crazy.
So Snyder also goes on in his article to talk much more extensively about that. He makes another point about how, you know, we know now it's come out several revelations that keep coming out about the crisis at the Capitol and the violent coup attempt, that there were off-duty policemen and ex-soldiers involved in this, an ex-psychological operations person from the military, and more keeps coming out by the day. And Snyder sees this as extremely dangerous because it's really a mixture within these police forces, or policemen who start to go over to the other side. And he sees that as a very characteristic of the way that fascist regimes come into power. He also then goes on at length in his article, his recent article titled The American Abyss, that I mentioned from the New York Times Magazine, and talking at length about the Republicans. He basically divides them into the gamers and the breakers, and the gamers as being those Republicans who work with the system through gerrymandering, dark money, voter suppression, etc., who are in favor of quote-unquote democracy that we have, but of course is a very limited one and bent in their favor. And then he talks about a smaller faction that he calls the Breakers. These are the Ted Cruz's and the Josh Hawley's, who've understood that one could actually come to power in the U.S. by entirely non-democratic means, basically by way of the mob, by way of throwing an election and lying about it. And so he's extremely alarmed about that. And then, you know, in passing, he mentioned there is a third, much smaller, weaker group, which would be an honorable few Republicans who, while we might disagree with their position, still actually believe in the rule of law and believe in telling the truth, at least sometimes. And so he points to Liz Cheney's stand in the wake of the crisis and Mitt Romney and a couple of others. But his core point about the Republicans is, he says, the interesting thing to watch now is, and I'm going to quote from him from a recent interview, is whether, quote, whether the center of power in the Republican Party now shifts from being the breakers and the gamers together to being the gamers and the honorable few together. He thinks that's what's now likely to happen. I think that's a little bit optimistic, but that's the way he sees it.
But I think that's what is happening in the impeachment process.
For the moment. And we'll come back to that. But he thinks that ultimately that would be probably a best case scenario for the Republican Party, that it's gotten itself into this kind of dead end where it is right now. And he sees what happening to the Republican Party now is basically the only thing that could have happened. And he goes on to say, quote, if you don't try to win campaigns with policy, but you try to win them by gaming the system, eventually there are going to be people who say, hey, let's not game the system anymore. Let's just break the system. And that's exactly what we just saw happen. And then he concludes that part of his discussion in saying, quote, there's nowhere to go from there except further down into chaos and blood.
Well, let's hope we don't go there.
But I think, you know, there's a few other points that Snyder said that I want to conclude this part of the discussion with, where to underscore the severity of the crisis that we are still in and that we are still mid-coup is a few points to make here. He says, the more that we learn, the less this looks like a coup bound to fail, and the more it looks like plain luck that all of our legislators and our vice president were just simply not murdered on January 6th. Mm-hmm. He's also made a very important point, kind of underscoring some of the things we've already discussed, where he says, when black people and their allies exercise freedom of speech, it's called insurrection. We saw that last summer. Mm-hmm. When white racists carry out violent insurrection, that is called free speech.
Yes.
Right? In this current paradigm. And then the last point, and this is extremely important, 192 Republicans voted for treason, sedition, insurrection, and authoritarianism. And 192 Republicans sided with the people who murdered a cop and then came hunting for their colleagues. A disaster was averted, we know now, by literally 60 seconds. And those 192 Republicans are there. So the coup and people who facilitated it, and a lot of these, it's going to for sure come out, played very key roles in orchestrating it, are still in the government. So we have like roughly 35-40% of the government who are literally, by definition, guilty of treason, sedition, and insurrection. And they are there, and they're not going away. So how this is dealt with going forward with the Biden administration, This moment, these next months are really going to determine whether we're setting the stage for another of these in 2024, which Zainab warns about, or is it possible to avert that?
And the signs aren't that good so far. Those same Republicans now are generating more big lies. Like, one of them is that Pence was organizing this insurrection. Pence, who they set up a scaffold for and were trying to capture to hang in the public square.
Right. And you can find easily available video of that, of the crowd jamming through the doors, chanting in unison, hang Mike Pence, hang Mike Pence. So, yes. You know, any of this, you know, the Republicans coming out and talking about, you know, unity and forgiveness and things like this is just, you know, absurd at this point. I think we can't underscore the gravity of this crisis and how very much on the front end of it we really are, and how this plays out over the next months is going to play a critical role in determining where this country is at in 2022 and then even more importantly in 2024.
And with this show, we, as I said at the opening, we bring up these very hard to discuss issues because they have crucial importance for how we move forward in the future.
And just like with, for example, when the virus became apparent this was going to be a very big deal and was going to slam this country, especially by the lack of appropriate action by the government, the federal government. We all read as much as we could. We learned about the importance of wearing masks and washing our hands and social distancing and limiting how much public interaction of any kind that we have. And then we behaved accordingly once we had that information and understood the dangers and the severity of the crisis. And that's why so many of us, fortunately, haven't caught the virus. Well, similarly with this coup attempt, we've gone to great lengths, Robert and I, to really just try to find the most relevant articles published to date and talk about them and then provide links to them and really encourage folks to give them a read, think about it, talk about it, because it's really helped kind of give us a very sharp lens to look through by which to have a very focused perception of what's going on in order to be able to behave accordingly. And because if we're going to be living in a country that is a high likelihood of having an ongoing overt domestic terrorism now happening sporadically between now and the next election, we need to be looking at it very clearly so we can make very sober decisions for ourselves.
Yes, well said. And we're about out of time. It's been a challenging and stimulating discussion, and I look forward to the next one. We'll probably bring in for our next show, I think we'll be interviewing somebody from one of these people that we have talked about.
Yeah, that I think will be an important thing to just keep an ongoing focus on this, because I'm sure there's going to be much, much more developments between even just over the next couple of weeks, and we'll bring in one of these experts and get deeper into this.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Dar. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, Robert.
Critical Conversations is produced at KPTZ Port Townsend. Comments are welcome and should be sent to contactus@kptz.org. Music is from 1960 What by Gregory Porter.